Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, the crime drama Person of Interest tells the story of two men who help stop crimes before they happen. It's been praised for raising questions about the role of surveillance in society. Rapper, actor, writer, and comedian Donald Glover talks about his new album. And jazz pianist Keith Jarrett says his new, completely improvised solo recording is one of the best he's ever made. But first,
with the current NBA lockout, TV networks like ESPN and TNT have had to figure out how to fill the holes left by canceled games. And they may lose advertising revenue, as NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
ESPN was ready. They say they put a contingency plan in place over a year ago.
But Texas A&M has so many points. Is their ability to run the football?
College football and basketball. That's pretty much what you'll see instead. And sometimes ESPN is just making SportsCenter longer.
Top 10, the greatest moments of Coach K's record career.
Over at TNT, they're just sticking to their regular schedule.
You really think that I was about to just roll over and...
That means on Thursday nights, it'll be CSI New York over and over again.
Welcome to the end of the world as we know it.
For that murdered girl, maybe, but for TNT, it is not the end of the world. Yes, they may have lost some advertising revenue, but they also saved some money. That's what John Martin, the CFO of parent company Time Warner, told investors in a conference call on November 2nd.
Now, for planning purposes, we're assuming here that there will be no NBA games in the fourth quarter.
Did you hear that? They weren't even planning on having any games. And he said lost ad revenue would be offset by the money they save not having to pay the NBA for broadcast rights.
So the impact to adjusted operating income from the lost games in the fourth quarter should be relatively immaterial.
Relatively immaterial, for now. Because early in the NBA season, not as many people are watching. The real money kicks in later. Dan Hirshhorn, who writes for Advertising Age, says more than half of ad dollars are actually spent in the playoffs.
And more than two-thirds or so are spent after the All-Star break in February.
So Hirshhorn says the TV networks could lose heavily if the whole NBA season is canceled. Plus, there are other networks like Comedy Central and Spike TV that cater to a young male audience. Hirshhorn says a network like TNT needs to watch out for poachers.
Networks who deliver a similar young male demographic are starting to go to these advertisers and say, listen, there's not going to be a season. Advertise with us instead. We can deliver for you better.
In other words, keep your eye on the ball. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Just about every show on network television is a type. The family drama, the workplace comedy, the doctor show, the talent competition. This season, the networks are adding quirky elements to freshen up those classic formulas, as TV critic Eric Deggans reports.
Here's the problem with watching TV after 50 years of innovation in technology and storytelling. Sometimes, it takes an awful lot to get your attention.
The woman who broke into your house is on her way here, and she's not happy.
Got a gun.
How else to explain NBC's Grimm, which is a typical crime of the week drama with a special twist? The hero cop can see fairy tale villains disguised as ordinary people. Here's our hero, Detective Nick Burkhart, learning about his new talent from his dying aunt.
The Reapers followed me here. That means there could be more.
How many were there?
Nobody knows. They're a secret organization dedicated to killing us.
You mean Grimms? They're more like us?
Yes.
Here's hoping, while sorting through all the Red Riding Hoods and Big Bad Wolves, he finds time to solve a murder or two. Fox's Terra Nova juices a lackluster family drama with its own sci-fi twist, dinosaurs, and CBS's unforgettable as Law & Order if one of the homicide cops had a photographic memory. But the trend seems to be getting a bit out of hand. Consider A Gifted Man, which reinvents the medical drama for CBS's female-friendly Friday night audience.
Patient's name is Lacey Sandreski, 19 years old.
Here's the twist. Hunky surgeon Patrick Wilson is revisited by the ghost of his dead ex-wife, teaching him to be a better man.
I'm not the bad guy here, Anna.
Yeah, it's not the same thing as being the good guy.
You don't want me to let her fly.
I think you should find out the whole story.
That may be a fantasy for female viewers, finally correcting that jerky ex from beyond the grave, but for guys, it sounds like a special circle of hell. The real problem with too much reinvention is that it makes shows look schizophrenic, as if producers couldn't decide what kind of show they're really making. That's what ails ABC's Pan Am, a messy collision of genres mashing a Mad Men-style 60s homage.
Come fly with me.
With an empowerment story for women.
You need to decide right now, because this is your life. What do you want to do with it?
And believe it or not, a James Bond-style espionage thriller.
Monte Carlo Casino VIP room. Mr. Lonzo will be gambling with a friend of his. She's a Soviet agent. We'll need her fingerprint.
I'm confused, and I don't even have to fingerprint the UN attaché and his Russian agent girlfriend or whatever. There is, however, one series handling the whole reinvention thing pretty well. ABC's blockbuster family comedy, Modern Family. There's no crazy twist here. It's just a great comedy centered on three couples and an extended family, with side-splitting scenarios that seem drawn from real life.
Sweetheart, what's this?
We talked about this last week. I said I'm building Luca Treehouse. You said fine. You know, sometimes I think you just tuned me out.
I never told her. She just would have said no.
I don't remember agreeing to this, Phil. This is like the time you backed down the driveway with a hang glider sticking out of the car.
If you'd let me keep that, those geese would have followed me to the wetlands.
You would have died.
A hero.
Good acting, great writing, human characters played by amazing actors. That might be the one twist network TV hasn't tried quite often enough.
Eric Deggans is the TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg
Times.
The new
CBS crime drama, Person of Interest, tells the story of two men who prevent crimes before they can be committed. Excuse me. They find out about the crimes by looking at data gathered by intelligence surveillance designed to catch terrorists. The series was picked up by CBS after the network says it tested better than any other series in recent memory. The show's producer is J.J. Abrams, creator of the hit show Lost, and Jonathan Nolan, who co-wrote The Dark Knight. He created that series and also produces it. Both men have brought their knowledge of suspense and crime to the meaty subject of privacy and surveillance. But in a time of rapid advancement of technology and heightened terror suspicion, it's unclear to some where the line of fiction ends and where reality begins. Joining me now to talk about the series are the executive producers, Jonathan Nolan and J.J. Abrams. Welcome to both of you.
Hi. Thanks so much.
So CBS is saying that this show has tested better than any other show in recent memory. What do you think happened here? Why does this resonate with viewers?
I think it feels like there's sort of an undercurrent here that we've tapped into. We like to say, I mean, there's a heightened aspect to the show. We like to say that reality is one firmware upgrade away from the show. That's the difference.
And am I speaking with Jonathan or J.J. at that?
This is Jonathan.
Okay, Jonathan, thank you. I needed to clarify that. J.J., hello to you as well.
Hello.
All right. I just wanted to establish the different tones in your voices. So the two main characters use this database that they call it the machine, and it collects information from everywhere, phone calls, credit card records, internet searches, and works on the notion that you can find patterns in these things using algorithms and, in theory, find out what people are doing. So Michael Emerson, who played the fantastic character of Benjamin Linus in Lost, is now Finch in this program. He plays the billionaire who invented this system and is now putting it to something of a private use. Let's listen to him as he describes it to somebody in the program.
This thing looks for plotters, for schemers. It looks for malicious intent. We built it to stop terrorists before they could act. But a machine doesn't understand the difference between those crimes that are relevant to national security and the ones that are irrelevant.
So what happens in the program is he and a colleague whom he hires go out to solve the crimes that are considered irrelevant, or to at least to approach, look at, and investigate the acts of violence that are irrelevant, and those can be mafia hits and lovers' quarrels, all sorts of things like that. And what's really interesting, and you alluded to this a little bit, Jonathan, is the plausibility of this. Is this something that could be for real soon, now?
Well, the government's been actively trying to build something exactly like this for at least 15 years. So the science fiction sort of question of the show is simply whether or not, you know, the government's competent enough to have achieved it. That's really the only question you have to ask yourself. John Poindexter, famously of the Iran-Contra affair back in the day, was heading DARPA in 2003, 2004, and tried to build something called the Total Information Awareness Program, which was basically exactly what we sort of postulate in the show.
But Congress found out and shut him down, we think.
Well, what happened kind of hilariously is that Congress found out and shut down the program in DARPA. Mm-hmm. And what happened was Poindexter moved it into the NSA. So it went from being in the public eye to being top secret. So we really have no idea what happened to that program.
JJ, the part of this that I think also connects with every viewer who's a citizen of this country and a member of the culture, we all leave breadcrumbs behind us every day. We leave markers to where we've been, and maybe somebody could figure out where we're going, but we go through toll booths and past cameras, and we swipe credit cards, and we go online and do searches. And I kind of want to get a sense of whether that's what you're tapping into, is the notion that it's not just some bad guy who's being watched and is out there, but it's kind of all of us.
I think that when you look around, when you become aware, or in Jonathan's case, hyper-aware of the cameras that are watching all of us, you realize that over the course of any hour and any day, you're being observed almost constantly. And when you watch any documentary or reality show, you see how people become so accustomed to cameras on them that the cameras go away, they become invisible, and the people just behave. And that's kind of what we've all been conditioned to do. We're all in a reality program. And if you just realize how many cameras are actually on you, and you think for a second, oh, there's someone behind those cameras. They're just not, you know, cameras. They're cameras that are wired and tapped into networks that are observed. You know, people are observing these things. And that was really, for me, the most provocative aspect of this pitch that Jonah had, which was, who's watching? And what would happen if someone was watching and was able to predict crime? And we've all seen crime shows, but crime shows are usually a reaction to a crime that's pre-existed, that happens, you know, just when the show begins. And this show posits what would happen if we could prevent a crime. And you don't know if the person of interest every week is going to be a victim or a perpetrator.
Right. You don't know who your bad guy is.
And much as the show is about the idea of the surveillance state and asking that question, it's also assuming the surveillance state. We're sort of stuck with it.
I took note of Finch saying at one point the best place to hide is in plain sight, but I think a message that your show also tells us is that now everywhere is in plain sight, and that maybe there's nowhere left to hide. Guys, I want to thank you. Jonathan Nolan is creator and executive producer of the new CBS drama, Person of Interest, which airs on Thursdays. He joined us from our New York bureau. J.J. Abrams is the executive producer, and he joined us from NPR West. Thanks both for joining us.
Thank you.
There's something different about the music of Donald Glover. He's a comedian, a TV writer, and an actor in NBC's Community. He plays a community college student, a former athlete who discovers his inner nerd.
Kingdom Animalia, phylum, chordata.
And at one point ends up rapping with a friend about the human species.
Family hominidae, the genus is
homo.
But you know you're into me.
Because I am in a species known as sapien. Dogs used to eat me, but now they bring the paper in.
It's gonna take a lot to get me away from you.
Now Donald Glover has put out an album with lyrics from the perspective of a kid who is dismissed as a nerd.
All right, it's childish, baby. Mr. Talk about his neck again. Nerdy, black kid, whatever, man, I'm sick of him. That well-spoken token who ain't been hurt. The only white rapper who's allowed to say the N-word.
The album is called Camp. He put it out under the name Childish Gambino. And amid the jokes, Donald Glover is seriously thinking of the awkward kid he used to be.
I made this album for me when I was 13. Like, the things that I said in the album, I wish I had known when I was younger.
Am I serious? I don't even know. Are you hearing this? Just laugh at me. I ain't trying, I'm doing. These other rappers are foolish. I got fame, my A&R's a computer. Is there room in the game for a lame who rhymes? Who wears short shorts and makes jokes sometimes?
If I think about other rap lyrics that I've heard, I mean, there are a few kind of standard characters who appear with standard messages, which might be, for example, I'm really great, I'm really tough, I'm a great rapper, or life is very hard, life on the streets is very tough, and I'm as tough as I need to be to deal with it. You, however, take the approach of a young man who is just constantly vulnerable. He's a loser.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you. second of all, totally. You know, I never really felt like I was, like, cool or anything like that. And I also, on the album, I say all those things that, like, you know, quote unquote, like, regular rappers do. Like, you know, I'm great, I'm awesome, I have sex all the time, I do, you know, like, that's there too. But it's all part of the id of just, like, you know, everybody feels like they should have the best. But everybody also constantly feels like, oh, I'm the worst. Why am I doing this? I don't like myself. Like, and if they don't, then, like, you know, that's me.
This rap stuff is magic. I used to get called Oreo. I used to get more laughs when I got laughed at. Oh, you got a mixtape? That's fantastic. But everybody thought it was jokes, though. They have, right? The joke is I got flow, so don't act like...
Childish Gambino, I guess, would be me, like, my failures and my triumphs tenfold, you know.
This is a theme you pursue in both your music and your comedy.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like that's the only reason I'm allowed to do rap and comedy, is that they're kind of the same person. I've said this before, if I came out with, like, a rap thing and then it was like, yeah, man, I'm gonna shoot a baby. Like, it's like, people would be like, that's not you at all, you know, and they'd be right.
I want to play a clip from a Comedy Central program that you did where you're talking about black nerds. Let's listen.
The best part about Obama is that he's a black nerd. I love that junk. Because I'm a black nerd, and that was illegal until like 2003. It's so awesome. It's just like there's black nerds everywhere, you know, like it's awesome. It's just like they're everywhere now. But it was just hard for us growing up. Like, you know, I remember I was like the only black kid at my school for a while. And white kids were excited. They were like, oh, we got a black kid. This is awesome. We got a black kid. They were like, hey, Donald, what kind of rap music you into? And what kind of sneakers you like? And I was like, oh, I don't really like rap music. I really enjoy the soulful stylings of the Cranberries. We can talk about that. And they were like, nah, man, you like sneakers and you like rap music. And you go, tell us which one you like. I was like, oh, you're hurting me, Steven, you know?
No, that's my life. Yeah.
You're playing with stereotypes, and we think of stereotypes as being something that, for example, white people would apply negatively to African Americans. But what you actually have happening there is white kids who are excited about the stereotypical black person they expected to meet and are a little disappointed not to run into that kid.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it still happens today, like, probably because, you know, I'm not intimidating. Like, I'm just talking about, you know, my own stuff.
You also talk about African Americans who apply stereotypes to themselves. For example, the stereotype that a black kid is not likely to have a father around the house.
Yeah, I mean, black kids are told every day who they are. Like, every day. The thing is, like, I talked to my dad about it. My dad didn't, like, really like himself or figure out, like, how am I balancing who I am until he was, like, a father of three already. Like, it was just, wow. like, that's crazy to me. And, you know, we put stereotypes on ourselves. Like, everybody does that. But I think it's just a little harder for black kids to just, like, you know, be who they are, because the people on both sides are telling them who they are all the time. Television's telling who you are. Like, everybody is telling you who you are and who you can be and what your limits are.
This one kid said something that was really bad. He said I wasn't really black because I had a dad. I think that's kind of sad, mostly because a lot of black kids think they should agree with that. If you're a father, you should stick around if you could. Because even if you're bad at it, you could Tiger Woods or MJ. We warriors, we all need senseis.
It's hard, I feel like, as a black guy or a black kid to connect with everybody, because the thing is, it's just like the only thing that has really been given to us to connect is negative stuff.
Well, I want to ask about one more lyric that you rap. I always wanted to get picked on the cool team, but alone is exactly how I should be. listening to it, I wondered, as an adult now, are you comfortable with who you are?
I don't know. I mean, like, I like who I am. Like, I feel like I'm a good person. I work hard. I definitely feel like I do that. But I feel like, you know, I make mistakes all the time. And, you know, I think that line was just like, hopefully making this thing will make it easier for little Donalds.
Well, Donald Glover, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks very much.
No, thank you.
On April 9th of this year, the jazz pianist Keith Jarrett sat alone on a stage in an old opera house in Rio de Janeiro. His only company, a piano, an American Steinway. And for nearly 2 hours, Jarrett played, as he often does, without any idea of what was coming next. It was sheer improvisation. And the result was some of the best music, Jarrett says, he's ever produced in a storied career spanning almost 50 years. I recently spoke with Keith Jarrett about that night and this recording. It's now available as the album Rio. It's incredible to hear any of your solo performances, and this one in particular, and know that it's more than 2 hours of improvised music, not a single note on paper, not an outline, but sounds and emotions that seem to be guiding your fingers. What process do you go through to prepare to do that?
It's never the same. The process I go through differs depending on when dinner is, depending on what I had for dinner, depending on whether I think I want a moment of privacy before I go on. I have no idea, moment to moment, how to prepare for these things either. What actually happens is so much in the moment, so much of a nanosecond. And I know a lot of people probably are skeptical about whether they really are always improvised. I myself feel skeptical, even though I know they were totally improvised.
It almost sounds like you're describing an out-of-body experience.
Yeah, I could say it's an out-of-body experience. I mean, for example, what I'm doing in each place I play, and Rio was a good example, better than most, I get to the place, I try to absorb the culture that I'm in, listen to the language, think about where I am, and that's about the only preparation that might be important. It was obvious when I listened to the CD that I was connecting with the culture. It wasn't Holland or Germany or the States or Japan, it was south of the equator. So that made me free of something, I think.
You often perform with your longtime collaborators, Gary Peacock and Jack DeJohnette.
Yeah.
But when you perform solo, like you did for this album, Rio, just you on the stage, does it in some ways free you up to do things that you couldn't do otherwise?
Oh, absolutely. But you have to be able to be ready to fall on your face, flat on your face, and have failed miserably. Like Jennifer Beals in Flashdance. You know, she falls over. It's her worst nightmare come true. But what can you do that's worse than that if you're dancing? So it's the same with this. But I have a connection with the instrument due to how long I've played it. It's like almost a talisman.
I'm speaking with jazz pianist Keith Jarrett. His new solo recording is called Rio. This, to me, it is an incredibly hopeful and joyful record. And you can really hear it coming through your fingers. And It's amazing that it's improvised because there's an intuitive logic to the recording. It moves seamlessly.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me like there is a story you're telling.
Well, if there's any story that I'm telling, I would have to, in some way, invent it because I never think of it like that. But, you know, I went through a divorce 3 years ago. Mm. Whenever a change happens in a person's life, especially large change and especially unpredictable one, like your spouse leaving or something, if you're an artist, you can use that. That's an energy force. It doesn't feel good. But if you're an improviser, you wonder, what will I play now? So for a while, the curiosity of your new situation creates the music. But in Rio, it's, as you say, much more positive and much more hopeful and much more joyful. And I remember being at ease, and I can only say that that was because of a new relationship, partly. Something about the way my life has gone has allowed me to weave through that stuff and use the next experience in my life as fuel for the music. And this particular fuel was full of hope.
This relationship was in its early days, and things have progressed, I understand.
Yes, yes, I now am engaged.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I don't remember anything like this in my life that that's comparable.
Hearing you talk about this record, it's clear that you are in a pretty extraordinary place in your life. I mean, to feel like you're producing your best work at this point, after a career of 5 decades, it must be incredibly gratifying.
Yes, it is. It is. I felt strangely at ease on stage, which is rare anyway, no matter what people think, no matter how many hundreds of times I've done it. It doesn't get easier. It gets harder because my whole goal is not to repeat myself and in some way bring something else into the world that wasn't there before in quite that way. I was fortunate enough, or maybe it was in the stars, for me to be in that room at that moment with that piano, although the piano was not perfect at all. It was an American instrument, the only American instrument on any solo album I've made. And it was an old opera house, and everything was sort of funky, but Rio was beautiful, so there was beauty, funkiness. Those elements were hanging around, and the music wouldn't have come out the same anywhere else.
Well, Keith Jarrett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's jazz pianist Keith Jarrett. He joined us from his home in Oxford, New Jersey. His new album of solo improvisational piano jazz is called Rio.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.